The following is with the man from Amsterdam, David de Jong, a Dutch investigative journalist who used to work on the billionaire's desk in New York for Bloomberg. His job there was to uncover hidden fortunes and as well explore the power of the huge private wealth of family offices all across the world. It was during this job that he discovered, one day, a very undescript website which documented an 18 billion euro wealth which was connected to a German family office. David pulled that thread all the way back to the upper echelons of the Nazi Party. And this moment then led David down what became a four-year path. He moved to Berlin to embark on this investigation, which led him into the darkest and dustiest vaults of Germany's corporate past. What he uncovered was Nazi wealth that has endured to this day and has its tentacles wrapped around many companies that you and I would consume or interact with every single day. Not least of which, everyone's favorite pizza, the frozen Dr. Oetker's. In this podcast, David speaks about growing up in Amsterdam, the amazing power of family offices and hidden wealth, the slave labor from Nazi concentration camps, billionaire Nazis, whitewashing of history, and a bit about serendipity as well. Now, before we get to the podcast, be sure to pump your good juice into the algorithm and share this podcast with a friend, because if you are interested in this, then you'd be keen to check out my Financial Secrecy Starter Pack, which is to list all of the episodes of a similar nature to this very one, which you're about to listen to. The link for that is in the description. And don't forget that this podcast took me 5 hours to put together, and if it only takes you 5 seconds to review, then I would very much appreciate you doing that for me. Now, without any further ado, here is the great Dutchman, David de Jong. First of all, Mr. de Jong, talk about growing up in Amsterdam.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I'm there currently. I mean, it's a great place to grow up because you live in a city, but it feels like a village, which, you know, as you grow older, it becomes more kind of suffocating and you want to get out. But as a kid, it's wonderful. You know, and I even stuck around to do my bachelor's degree there. So couldn't really fathom myself studying anywhere else. I mean, I had already plans to go abroad after that. So so it's nice. And I come back frequently. So it's really, you know, I mean, it's changed a lot. It's become far more international in the past 10, 15, I would say the past decade, the past 10 years. And, you know, it's also kind of overrun by tourists now, but it's great. I mean, I will always come back there. It's, you know, I don't think it will, I mean, it will always be a base for me. I'm not sure if I will live here again, but like permanently, but, you know, I will always come back. I mean, all my childhood and university and the friends are here, and of course my family is, so yeah, so it's good, always good to be back.
So you grew up there in the 90s. Talk a little bit about the change, because I remember living there only a few years ago, that people would talk about how it was much more dangerous or there was much less tourism.
I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, it was definitely never felt dangerous to me, because I think, you know, where like the areas where a lot of like junkies were and stuff, you know, I wouldn't really go there as a 8, 9, 10 year old. So it felt very safe. But, you know, it was a less international city. So there were also less tourists. And I remember that when I started studying 2004, 2005, my undergraduate studies at the University of Amsterdam, you know, all the big museums were closed for massive renovations, and that took like a decade or something. So there was also a reason why there were just fewer tourists, you know, or perhaps, let's put it this way, the influx of stag do's and hen parties, you know, exploded, whereas the kind of those tourists that were looking for more, cultural place to visit, at that point, pretty much dipped. And I think now it's probably on par, but they're, you know, both numbers are completely out of control.
This might seem like a random question, but how do you reflect as a Dutch person, living in a bunch of different cultures now? If you could just turn the lens on your own culture, what do you make of Dutch people?
The Dutch are a funny bunch. I think they're very, oh, I mean, they're very open and forthright and blunt, and kind of all those things. But I think that's all quite surface, because one thing, now that I'm living in Israel at the moment, I think particularly my German fiance, she's, quite, she can't really deal, she finds the aggressiveness of Israelis really hard to deal with. But as somebody growing up in the Netherlands, you're like, it's I don't mind it that much. I mean, I mean, the Israelis are next level, but I would say growing up in Amsterdam, it's or growing up in the Netherlands, you can definitely, there's not, I find living in Tel Aviv not that much. Well, it's very different, but I don't find the kind of the elbowing that much of a change from growing up in Amsterdam. And other than that, I think the Dutch are very open, but I think it's quite a superficial thing always, really getting into kind of socially. I think for an outsider, it's really hard to get into, there's Dutch culture and there's expat culture in Amsterdam. I think it's there's very little crossover between the two. And that's something that I struck when I moved to Berlin from New York in 2017, was really how welcoming, actually, how Germans on the surface are much more reserved, but how they're, once you, as soon as you get deeper, they're far more open in a way, far more open to outsiders, which, I think that's one thing about, Germans that people don't, wouldn't necessarily say or associate with.
What about growing up in Amsterdam, the connection to the Nazi history? When did the significance of the gold plates out the front of doors become known to you?
Well, that's only something that's quite recent, these kind of, that's only something that they've started doing in the Netherlands in the past recent years, where they where they took it after the, of course, it was a German who came up with that. And they've only started doing that in recent years. But I think what was striking to me growing up in the Netherlands is how little you learn about Dutch, the Dutch culture, or like the Dutch attitude during World War II, or during German occupation, I would say. So May 4, 1940, May 1945. And that really, I think that's something that only in recent years, where the Netherlands, relative to population, deported the most Jews. Well, the Netherlands under German occupation had the most Jews deported relative to population, only behind Poland and Hungary. And there's now actually, 2 weeks ago, this really good book came out by the New York Times correspondent in Amsterdam. Her name is Nina Segal. Definitely somebody you should have on your podcast. And she wrote a book called The Diary Keepers, which looks at seven Dutch people during World War II, three Jews, two people in the resistance, and two Nazi collaborators. And she was struck as a Jewish woman who'd grown up in Long Island and Manhattan, moving to the Netherlands 20 years ago, just how, there was all this talk about Jewish culture, for example, but there's no Jews around, right? And she describes that quite, how they've kept that so secret. In the Netherlands, if you speak with anybody about their kind of World War II past, or not their World War II past, but their families, everybody was in the resistance, kind of, that's kind of the theme, and that's some kind of, you grew up with, oh, we were so great, but nobody talks about the widespread collaboration in the Netherlands. It was very prevalent.
What about your own family connection with the Nazis? Your grandfather served is the wrong word, was captured, prisoner in the camps.
I mean, I mean, it has nothing to do. I mean, the reason I wrote the book has nothing to do with my family history, because I always say, you know, I mean, there's tens of millions of Europeans who have similar, of European families who have similar stories to mine. You know, my grandfather from my mother's side, you know, he was Protestant, very kind of patriotic Dutchman, who you know was 25 when he was a very avid sailor, and he tried to sail with his best friend to the UK, to England, to join the Royal Air Force. And on the second attempt, they were blown back to shore and they were arrested by German soldiers. And he was sentenced as a political prisoner, and you know, was forced to work. You know, he was a forced laborer, slave laborer, work in a steel factory in Bochum in the Ruhr area. For my father's, and you know, he barely. You know, he was like 6 foot 5, and he came out, you know, emaciated, you know, weighing very little, and you know, was recuperated in a sanatorium in Switzerland, and they married my grandmother, and my mom was born not long thereafter, in the late 1940s, and you know, the eldest of four. And from my father's side, you know, they were Jewish, or my grandparents were Jewish, and my grandfather hid in Amsterdam, in the center of Amsterdam, for 3.5 years, and my grandmother fled with my aunt, who was then three. She's now 84. She still lives in Amsterdam. You know, they hid to Switzerland because my grandmother, or they fled to Switzerland because my grandmother was a Swiss citizen, and she was born and raised in Zurich. And they, you know, they fled together with a friend of them, Max van Damme, who was a famous painter. And they were caught by the Gestapo at the French-Swiss border. We're talking 1942, so really the height of deportations, and the height kind of the start of the Shoah. And yeah, this Gestapo officer took pity on my grandmother and I, because she was, you know, had a 3-year-old with her. And told, okay, go back, leave tonight, or like, you know, report back tomorrow morning. And they fled that night over the mountains to Switzerland, aided by a shepherd and the maid in the hotel. But you know, Max van Damme, he reported back the next morning, and he was deported and was murdered in Sobibor. So you know, it kind of goes to show how. Yeah, how, you know, history is, you know, I always think it's kind of a miracle that I'm here from either side, you know, whether Christian, Jewish, you know, it's like, yeah, whatever grandparent, you know, I think it's just, but I think again, that's the story of tens of millions of Europeans from this era, you know, alive today, and of course, so
No,
many aren't.
there's no need to hide in the masses and say just because it's a story of 10 million others doesn't make that own story extremely significant.
Oh no, for me, of course, it's incredibly significant in the sense that it's the reason I'm alive today,
Yeah.
but I do think it's important to put it in a proper historical context. No.
Does that ever sort of influence your decision making or the way you think about the world? This sort of
Never.
hyper knowledge of what could have been?
Never.
No, I guess not.
Never.
What
No,
about
that's not a way to live.
your grandfather hid in Amsterdam for 3 years? What stories did he share with you and his family about that time?
He passed away in 1973, so I never got the chance to know him. I mean, I was born in the late 1980s, so unfortunately, my father was quite young when he passed. So my father was only 23. So, but what I did get to know, and this is in many ways, you know, another part of the journey, kind of started around 2009. It's all kind of linked with the book. But when I first moved to New York for my master's in the fall of 2009. Was a master's in history and international relations, and my aunt was visiting. The aunt, now 84, Jacqueline. She's an artist. She's a painter, and she was in New York because she had an exhibition at a university in Connecticut, And she was reading she read the front page of the weekend edition of New York Times. There was an article there about a woman who together with her mother and grandmother had saved Jews in Amsterdam, or had hid Jews in Amsterdam during World War II. And then there was a description of a man, and my aunt was like, "That's your grandfather, you know." Or she describes your grandfather in this book and or in this article. And then, you know, she and then my aunt wrote to this woman called Tina Strobels, who had immigrated to the US after World War II and became a child psychiatrist. And, you know, I got to interview her spring 2010 for a class that I was taking on oral history. We kind of became, you know, friendly. I went to visit, I celebrate her 90th birthday with her. And she told me all these stories. And there was actually a book written about her by a Dutch journalist, which came out a couple of years after she passed, because she died in, I would say, also 2012. She died. Yeah. No. Yeah. It was 2012. Yeah. And so she, yeah. So she told me all the stories about kind of how they made a party out of it a little bit while in hiding, you know. But my grandfather, you know, he would like kind of, yeah, they would have tried to make the best times of it, you know. So yeah, that's kind of how I got that story, these kind of stories to me.
And forgive me if I'm belaboring the point, but when he's talking about hiding, is he sort of under floorboards? Is he in a secret room? Or is he just having adopted another identity but living in plain sight?
No, they would stay inside. They would stay the house. It was kind of this canal house. It wasn't on the canal, but it was very near the canals. And there were all kind of secret compartments and hidden attics and et cetera, et cetera. And he was, I think, I mean, they could just be in the house during the day, but they couldn't really leave. I mean, barely. Yeah.
Well, how did a master's in history and international relations end up teeing you up a job at the billionaire's desk at Bloomberg?
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, I did my master's, and it was 1 year in New York, 1 year in London, and afterwards I came back to New York because I got a 1 year work visa, which every graduate, foreign graduate of a bachelor's and master's program gets in the US. And so I was looking for a job in New York in media. And then via, I got introduced to a new team that they were starting at Bloomberg, which looked at family-owned companies and hidden wealth. And yeah, and I interviewed with the team, and it was a good fit. So and I was actually hired as one of the, because I mean, one of the blind spots of Bloomberg was to, you know, they focus on listed on stock exchange listed companies and not so much on family-owned companies and family offices. And it was a huge space there to be covered, and so many good stories that would come out of that. And that's how I, you know, and I was interested in doing, you know, in doing more, you know, doing a lot of research, doing more investigative stuff already right from the bat. And yeah, so it was kind of natural fit. I mean, I was actually hired as the North America reporter on that team, and then they soon asked me if I could cover the German speaking countries because I'm Dutch, and they thought, you know, this Dutchman speaks fluent German, you know, because it's all one the same.
It's all one thing.
So yeah, and then that's
You're
how I
just
came
tall
on the topic
Germans.
of the book as well. Yeah, exactly. Right.
But you were reluctant, weren't you, to leave New York and to do the German desk?
Well, I wouldn't leave New York. I didn't
Oh,
have to
okay.
leave New York. I didn't, you know, I could do it from New York. So that was no. I would do it from New York, and I would travel to Germany for a month, a year, between Thanksgiving and Christmas. I would go and do a reporting trip in Bloomberg bureaus in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland.
That must have been such an exciting time.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun, you know. It was great. It was exciting, for
You
sure.
said there were so many good stories in these family offices and more private wealth, the desk you were covering. Now, you obviously tackled the history of these German private all family offices and private families. But I wonder, you and your colleagues, between you, what is another geographical region or a specific part of history or right now, somewhere in the world, where incredibly interesting stories of family offices and private wealth are playing out today?
Well, I'm currently a Middle East correspondent, and I can tell you, in terms of hidden wealth and kind of family office space and just,
So it's
you
all
know, the money,
Dubai.
you know, well, not no, but I would say Qatar, it's the Gulf for sure, it's Saudi, Qatar, Emirates, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, you know, people always talk, but it's Abu Dhabi as well, very much so, even perhaps even more so than Dubai. But you know, I do think that the Gulf in terms of well, it's not so much hidden, but there is a lot hidden there. Because now, you know, the entire capital markets now, you know, there's no IPO happening in Europe and the US at the moment. I mean, well, especially see what's happened the past couple of days, you know, Credit Suisse being shored up with a 50 billion injection from the Swiss National Bank today. You know, bankruptcy or yeah, bankruptcy and bailout of Silicon Valley Bank. You know, but in the but in the in the in the Gulf, you know, the IPOs are like it's there's a total. I mean, they're privatizing the economies. You know, which was state owned, especially if you look at Saudi and the Emirates. They're trying to make a shift away from. They want to diversify the economies away from natural resources, and you know they just of course had a banner year with energy prices through the roof. So they've made so much money. I think Saudi Aramco announced on Sunday or last week that they've made a profit of 150 billion over 2022, and yeah, so I think that is definitely the most exciting space. You know, South America, I would say Southwest Asia, also fascinating. Africa, you know, yeah. I mean, my focus at that time was the US and Western Europe. So yeah, so that's yeah,
Are you
that
prepared
so
to tantalize us with the potential scoop that you have in mind?
yeah, I'm definitely not gonna say that on a podcast.
All right, back to you said that you were a good fit for Bloomberg. I am under the impression that, you know, it's extremely hard to get that type of job. And at the time, you would have been in your late 20s, mid 20s. So you must
Mid
have done
twenties, I was 25.
something pretty impressive to get on there. Do you know what that was?
I mean, I had a good click with my editors who I met, you know, and I think, I remember, you know, I think everybody else that they interviewed, they said, "Oh, who do you want to cover?" And everybody said, "You know, Steve Jobs, who was then still alive." I mean, this was just before he passed. This was like September 2011 when I did Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg. And I'm personally not super interested in Silicon Valley tech and etc. So I also, you know, said more kind of the things I wanted to cover were also more like kind of the family office space, privately owned, family owned companies. And I think they were struck more with the fact that I really wanted to get into weeds and, of course, focus on families who do not, you know, where there's family businesses where, you know, it's hard to get, you know, revenue figures. It's pretty much impossible to get any kind of profit figures, EBITDA figures. So I think, yeah, the fact that I really wanted to get in the weeds and focus on that rather than, you know, focusing on Silicon Valley, which was kind of a, yeah, which at the time was very exciting, but also, yeah, it's kind of, okay, sure, it's kind of a vanilla answer that, yeah, that I think that set me apart.
Nice. So maybe you could pull off the lid and take us into the world of family offices, how much wealth are we talking about? How significant is the power behind this money? What's something interesting that you learned?
Wow. I mean, the vast wealth of family offices today, I mean, it's been growing incredibly. That space been growing incredibly in the past decade. But it's, you know, it's an unregulated market, but we're talking about, you know, trillions of dollars and euros of wealth already. Wow. And it's vast spending power. You know, whether it's in real estate or private equity funds or private equity deals, even where family offices team up and start doing private deals themselves, rather than through, you know, your typical private equity companies or team up with private equity companies to take a company private. You know, it's still a very private space. It's fascinating in the sense that how much private capital can, how much families or even individuals, you know, can wield power. And I think that's also something that's interested me generally on that topic is, you know, I don't really like abstract stories about, you know, companies or banks or whatever, where it's kind of these kind of nameless, faceless entities. You know, it's really,
sure,
I like focusing on the individual and or on the family, where you have characters, you know, that drive a narrative forward, or, you know, people are such an interesting story, you know, and I think, you know, individuals with enormous amounts of you know, economic and financial influence, you know, whether by birth or by self-made or however, it that always gives for fascinating stories.
Do you have any insight into the Australian ecosystem of all of this?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't.
I just wanted to put out there interesting. No, but give us an example then of wielding power. You just said how these private individuals will wield power with their massive fortunes. Put a name to it.
Yeah, one of the families that I cover, you know, in the main family I cover in the book, at least one branch, you know, they control BMW. They control the BMW group, which is not only BMW, but it's also Mini and Rolls Royce. And it's you know, Germany's wealthiest siblings, Susanne Klatten and her brother, Stefan Kvant. And, you know, they own 47% of the BMW group. It's listed. And, you know, they got a dividend of 1 billion euros. And last week, you know, it's annual. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and they invest in many other things as well. And I think it's the sheer economic and financial power invested in one or two individuals that is also, I mean, it's fascinating. It's also kind of scary, you know, it is also, and of course it wasn't them, you know, they inherited that stake together with their mother at the time. But it's also really important to hold these kind of people to account. You know, I think that's what to kind of pivot to the book, my book, then it's more kind of a historical and moral reckoning that the focus is off. It's also kind of, what do you do with the responsibilities that you have, that you inherit?
I mean, before we do transition to the book, I'd like to hear you just talk a little bit about how this private wealth abuses the offshore and financial secrecy ecosystem. What you uncovered there?
I mean, it's changed a lot in the past decade, you know, whereas Switzerland has become, for example, has worked more with authorities and had gone, you know, post 2009, kind of this whole UBS American scandal UBS received a huge fine for having American clients who, you know, had billions stashed away in tax for tax evasion purposes, where, you know, kind of Liechtenstein is still a total wild west. You know, it's like don't put your money don't put your money there. I would say it, but all these other, you know, I mean, Singapore has become far more regulated, but now it's like Dubai. You know, it's like a lot of the Gulf, a lot of, you know, if you look, see now at Russians, you know, they're all flocking. Everybody's they're all flocking to Dubai, where, and not only Russians, but there's a lot of, I mean, you know, it's become also for, you know, for the cartel, for cartels like Italian mafia, Dutch criminals who were big in the cocaine trade, that they set themselves up in Dubai. Now there's actually now you know it's actually they're more at risk because there's extradition treaties between the Emirates and the Netherlands, for example. But there, yeah, I would say in offshore, and it's the U.S. actually. I mean, it's you have like Nevada, Wyoming, all these strange states that, and of course Delaware is the strongest. You know, the U.S. is a massive offshore center for both corporate and individual, offshore purposes or tax, fiscally attractive places to base yourself. And the Netherlands, you know, is still a corporate tax haven. You know, I mean, massive. I mean, it's nothing has been done to kind of clamp down on that. You know, the Dutch in their endless opportunism, you know, that's not something. And it's also favorable for expats. You know, there's a 30% rule for expats that they only have to pay 30% tax, as opposed to 54% or 56%, which is the highest tax
But
bracket in the Netherlands on
that
income.
specific, I used to actually work with a bunch of guys who were on that specific rule. I don't know if I'd class that as necessarily, you know, exploiting the ecosystem of offshore finance and financial secrecy. I'm speaking specifically about guys who are reporting their income in countries that they own a piece of property in, but they step foot in once a year, you know, even though they
Yeah, but
consume
that's
the
another.
public good of another country. Like real egregious
Right, but that's
stuff.
another. Yeah, right, but that's the Netherlands too. You know, I mean, I would say the 30 per the kind of it's the Netherlands is still one of the biggest corporate tax havens in the world, both for individuals and for corporations. So, there's all these lawsuits going on, and some have been going on for decades with regard to Russian assets being incorporated in the Netherlands. You know, Gazprom, and the likes who have massive entities here. You know, and that's why a lot of Nike has been here for decades. It's also just attractive. It's attractive to base yourself in the Netherlands as a company, as an international company, for that very reason. Well, it's one of the reasons, but it's often the main reason.
How do you think of the ethics of tax evasion or exploiting existing accounting shell companies, accounting tools that can make you dodge income? Just overall, how do you think about the ethics of it?
I mean, the ethics are, you know, I mean, there's all there's there, there's a very narrow line between, you know, tax avoidance and tax evasion often, right? I mean, whereas tax avoidance, which is what we're talking about here for the most part, you know, is just using the existing rules in place in whatever jurisdiction it may be to avoid taxes in wherever you base yourself. Vis-a-vis tax evasion, which, you know, is becoming more and more outdated, or at least, I naively seem to get that impression, perhaps. I mean, the ethics, even with tax avoidance, are pretty terrible. I mean, there's kind of still entire countries, small countries, that market themselves solely off of that, off of the, having that kind of
it's their
unique
main
selling point
export.
of yeah, exactly, yeah. Plenty of Caribbean or Pacific islands or other special jurisdictions who market themselves solely for that purpose. So those ethics are pretty terrible, I think, as a nation state. Yeah.
As we transition into the book, I'd like you to keep the offshore finance discussion top of mind, because it'd be fascinating to hear specific things that you discovered in it. But to transition,
sure.
You stumbled across this inconspicuous website of a person you just spoke about, Harold Quandt, and the holdings had $18 billion. And you asked, how's this obscure German family office with a bare-bones one-page website managed to invest such a staggering amount of money? So the book covers five families. And these are just some of the brand names that they're connected to. Household names. Siemens, ThyssenKrupp, who I think are the elevator guys. Allianz, the Oetkers of frozen pizza fame. BMW, Porsche, Mercedes-Benz, Volkswagen. And then as well some American companies. Krispy Kreme, Dewey Egberts. I think that's a Dutch company. Dr. Pepper. And then something that broke my heart, Pret a Manger. Because I've committed so much to their bottom line over the years. So,
who hasn't?
Of the, these are. It could it really be the case that all of these businesses are deeply connected with Nazi wealth?
Well, it's not so much the businesses themselves. Well, for a lot of them, there are, but I wouldn't say Pret a Manger, which was founded by a Jewish Londoner. has any ties? Yeah, it's about in generally, it's the families that owned them in the past, or that currently own them or control them, that have the ties with the Third Reich, with the exploitation, with profiteering of the Third Reich. So yeah,
well, maybe let's talk about a particular character from the book. Friedrich Flick, I thought, was a particularly egregious character.
Right.
Tell us about this fella.
Yeah, I mean, he's probably the most powerful German industrialist of the 20th century, a man who was Germany's wealthiest individual in 1930, 1945, and 1960, and at the time of his death in 1972, was, one of the world's richest men. Top five richest men. So he, he kind of personifies in a way the opportunism, because those that profited off the Third Reich were, for the largest part, sheer opportunists. There were some ideologues, but most of them, they just wanted to expand their businesses, their business fortunes, and their business empires. And they, he ran Germany's largest steel, coal, and weapons conglomerate during the Third Reich, and is the only one of my main characters who actually got sentenced after World War II in one of the trials at Nuremberg for war crimes and crimes against humanity, and he was sentenced to 7.5 years in prison in Landsberg prison outside of Munich. And his sentence was commuted in 1950, and he was allowed to keep all of his assets, or at least in West Germany. And when he came out, within 5 years, he was back on top as Germany's richest man, as the controlling shareholder of Daimler Benz. And, he was able to build out his conglomerate, easily.
There's a recurring theme of these characters, how they would just weasel their way into the Nazi party and almost feign the ideology the entire way. They were sort of like the archetypical cynical capitalist. And you wrote about them calculating, unscrupulous opportunists looking to expand their business empires at any cost.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these men, you know, and they were men, they weren't necessarily friends of Hitler and the Nazi Party, you know. They were kind of establishment conservative. They backed establishment conservative candidates, or whoever they considered to be best for their bottom lines and whoever economic policies were best. But what Hitler promised them and what he initially also delivered on was that, of course, you know, Hitler seized power in January 1933, off the back of, you know, coming off the it was the tail end of the Great Depression. And, you know, these men had lost part of their fortunes. I mean, there were millions of Germans were unemployed, you know, and had lost, you know, they wanted to save their businesses and their fortunes no matter what. And you know, Hitler initiated the largest rearmament program the world had ever seen at that point. And you know, you had billions, well, initially hundreds of millions of Reichsmarks, and soon billions of Reichsmarks flowing in back into the coffers of these industrialists, you know, who would start producing weapons, which is forbidden under the Treaty of Versailles, but, you know, to rearm Nazi ge or to rearm Germany, as Hitler already started, you know, ramping up to wars as early as, you know, early 1934. I mean, the goal was pretty clear. What Hitler already did, his aim, was pretty clear. It was expansion and occupation. So they, and it was, of course, I mean, to these men, you know, that was great. You know, they could revive their industrial companies, whether it was steel, coal, or weapons manufacturing companies, or batteries, or accumulators, or whatever they did to feed the German war machine, which of course continued on into World War II.
Could you give an example of a character who really embodies this idea where they themselves at their core were maybe apolitical? You know, they weren't Nazis. They maybe even didn't hold anti-Jewish sentiments, yet nonetheless, they pretended and put that skin on just to get the benefits of the Nazi Party.
Yeah, I think, you know, the two main characters in my book, I mean, who personified it, is Günter Quandt and Friedrich Flick, kind of embody that opportunistic sentiment, you know, where these were not, you know, they had Jewish board members who they, of course, summarily fired after the seizure of power. You know, they went along, but they would have thrived in any political system, right? Whether it was the German Empire, the Weimar Republic, Nazi Germany, occupied West Germany, reunified Germany. I mean, that I would argue they would even come on top in a communist system, you know. I think that's a personification, is to be able to thrive, to financially thrive in any political system, regardless of whether it's democratic, autocratic, whatever.
Bradley Hope called the book the Anti-Schindler's List. So, could you talk a
Right.
little bit about how these industrialists took advantage of the slave labor, the Jews in the concentration camps?
Right. I mean, in addition to mass rearmament, there were two other fields where these men massively profited from persecution. And one was, of course, the expropriation of Jewish-owned companies and, you know, family Jewish-owned companies and Jewish families, the assets of Jewish families or business families. And of course, the expropriation in German-occupied territories during World War II, as well as the mass exploitation of forced and slave labor during World War II, which was, you know, an estimated between 12 and 20 million Europeans were deported to Germany and forced to work in German factories and mines. And Friedrich Fleck had an estimated 100,000 forced slave laborers working for, that he exploited. And Günter Quandt had almost 60,000. Is a conservative estimate.
I mean, that's an incredible amount of people. It's a giant labor force.
It is. I mean, Hitler initiated the largest coerced labor program to date after he invaded in June 1941, after he invaded, or after his army invaded the Soviet Union, because all able-bodied men were at the front. They were at the East Front. They were fighting the Soviet Union, and he needed to keep feeding the Nazi war machine. And forced labor and slave labor were the ways for him to accomplish that goal.
And so, what were these prisoners doing? Like specifically, what were they making? How were they contributing?
I mean, they were making everything from, they were working in mines, they were manufacturing weapons, they were manufacturing tanks, automobiles, trucks, jeeps, you name it. I mean, it was anything that, under the most horrific circumstances, right? Where it would be abused at random, exploited at random, no medical care, no protective, no protective gear that they were wearing to protect them against acids or, malnourished, malnutrition, 40 people sleeping in one room, it was circumstances of these 12 to 20 million, of which 2.5 million estimate also died as forced and slave laborers. It was horrific.
Is there any way to do the accounting of just how much they exploited the slave labor? You've got numbers of how many they were, but maybe in how much economic value they created. I know it's almost impossible to know, but maybe if someone's attempted it.
Not to my knowledge, because I would certainly use that number in that. No, that's an impossible one. I think, given the perverse nature of the labor, I think as far as I know, no one's ever attempted to kind of quantify, how much trillions of output, because these people were also, already when they arrived, whether they were, Soviet prisoners of war or concentration camp captives or forced laborers from the East or wherever, or from the West, they were already often, they were forced, they were exploited, they were often malnourished or were wounded, they were abused. So it's there where you didn't have people working at full capacity, so it's also, I'm not sure if you try to quantify, did you give an accurate reflection of how, quote unquote, useful these people were.
So the heirs of these Nazi billionaires have grown richer since. Could you say, of the five families, that you could find out what their particular size stakes are in the different brands that we mentioned earlier?
Okay. So the BMW quants had owned about 47% of the BMW group.
That's huge.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, that stake represents, I think, 50 billion just in market value of BMW's market value. Somewhere around that. I haven't checked the BMW stock price in a while, but
and that's private money.
That's private wealth.
I mean, that's unbelievable.
Well, I mean, it's right. It's not. I mean, this is not liquid. I mean, it throws off a whole lot of cash, right? Because they got, this year they got a over last year, they got €1 billion in dividends between the two of them. Other years, it's 800 million. But yeah, so, but of course, the stake itself, it's, yeah, it's not a liquid. I mean, you can sell it down, but if your controlling shareholder starts selling down, then, that doesn't give a lot of
Confidence.
confidence in a company. So much of that stake is not, I mean, it's liquid, but it's not, yeah, it's not that liquid. And I mean, some of the families in the book that I write, some of them, they don't control an operative company anymore. They just invest their billions in through their family offices in art or real estate or private equity or hedge funds or you name it, like the Flick sort of von Finks, which is so family that co-founded Allianz in Munich Re. But then the Porsches, they just spun off, they just spun off Porsche from the Volkswagen Group, right? And the Volkswagen Group doesn't only control Porsche and Volkswagen, but also Audi, Lamborghini, Bentley, Skoda, Seat, it's the largest car manufacturer in the world, I think, together with a Chinese car company. And they own a majority of Porsche still, now that it's separately listed, and also of the Volkswagen Group, through all these, it's a pretty intricate model, but they have a majority in voting rights in both companies or both conglomerates. And the Oetkers, they had a split, so there was a big conflict between the eight siblings, the current heirs, and the conglomerate has been divided into two separate conglomerates, and five own Dr. Oetker, and the remaining three own the Oetker siblings conglomerate, which has certain assets, but that's 100% ownership because it's a private company.
A lot of the commentary I've seen around the book revolves around the sheer amount of work and research you had to do.
Yeah, that's true. I moved from New York to Berlin in October 2017, and it was just writing and researching a book was my focus for 4 years. My main focus for 4 years. I mean, I was freelancing on the side, but yeah, the book was every day. It was just full on.
All right, and what does that
Yeah.
involve?
Well, it involves going to a lot of archives in Germany and Europe and also North America. It involves, a lot of free writing. It involves just trying to synthesize enormous amount of information and seeing, what's relevant, what's not. I mean, the final book, it has, I think, 325 pages or so, like text. I think it's 400 all in all, with like 50% and 50 pages end notes, and you name it. But the book is 325, and I cut out 100 pages, which were like not even that they were. It's on the advice of my editor, which were just also not, in hindsight, like, wasn't really necessary. They were, yeah, it's good that they were cut out, but yeah, just a lot of things that were just repetitive or didn't really add to the narrative. Because that's, because you can't take the reader's attention for granted. You kind of have to keep them engaged in this narrative propulsion.
Well, the book is written like a narrative. I mean, it's stories. So it's very, very easy to consume from that perspective. But give us an example, right? So you discover this quant website, one pager built in the 90s. No one's touched it since. How do you then unravel that thread? you know, actually, what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the book is based on articles that I wrote for Bloomberg, right? So when I saw that website, I mean, it was the basis for an article I ended up writing for Bloomberg, and it was published in 2013. I mean, I went to the family office. I had an appointment and went with a colleague of mine from the Frankfurt Bureau, interviewed the CEO at the time. At the family office outside of Frankfurt, and you know, made an average also calculated annualized returns and stuff. But that was more for the Bloomberg angle. But for the book, you know, it was mainly going to the Quant Archive, family archive, which was in Darmstadt, which is also south of Frankfurt.
Mm.
Doing the research there. Spending a week in Darmstadt doing archival research.
And archival research is you're just trawling through hundreds, thousands of pages of business documents, personal, you know, correspondence.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. A mix of that. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then you're taking notes on the side.
A lot of personal correspondence, business. Exactly. Yeah. I see what's relevant for my, but you know, and then see what's relevant, what's not relevant, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you go back home, compile that in a big document, have several different documents to the different families, and then try to create a narrative between all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, for me, I'm projecting onto it, but it's an incredibly romantic idea of work.
Yeah. It's incredible. It's not that romantic. It's just work, you know, it's just a struggle. It's just work.
And
nothing romantic about it.
How has Germany reacted to your publication? Has it been published in German yet? And do people interview you over there? Is there any interest in your book coming out of Germany?
Very much. I mean, the original language version, the English version of the book was published in late April, or April 19, 2022. And the German version came out 2 weeks later. And it's an incredible translation, incredibly well done. They put, you know, the German publisher put enormous amount of efforts into it. And they put two translators on it and an external editor. And it's been incredibly well received. It was number one on the bestsellers list. Very good reviews, very good sales. You know, I think it's fourth, fifth printing now. You know, and I love giving talks in Germany because the questions are really good and they're always very nuanced and also critical, and they know the topic really well. And it's about Germany. I mean, it's about the world, but it's about Germany, the book. Yeah.
And what about the response from the families involved? How have you managed communication with them?
Well, I list all the response at the end of the book in the appendix, you know. I approach them either through their family offices or their spokespeople directly. And you know, they all rejected my interview requests, except for one grandson of Friedrich Flick, who I had his private email, or I'd like corresponded with him over email.
Mm.
Yeah.
But the nature of it.
And, you know, he was quite candid and reflective, you know. But even he said, you know, bad things have come out of my grandfather, but to us, to me, he's a genius who gave us so much more than wealth alone. So.
What did he give him?
I guess a role model, I guess an example, I guess. Right. Something. And then that's, you know, goes to show, I mean, the end of the book is this kind of whitewashing of history that the families that control BMW and Porsche engage in, right? Where they where they, you know, maintain massive global charitable foundations or media prizes or museums in the name of their fathers and grandfathers and celebrate them for their business success, but leave out their war crimes. And that's the reason that I wanted to write a book, was kind of shine a light on that. Shine a light on that, you know, the whitewashing of history that's still happening today. And also how the difficulties they find it to kind of, you know, separate themselves from, you know, kind of, yeah, kind of critical separation from their fathers and grandfathers in that sense.
And so what should be done about your discoveries?
I mean, I think people should make up their own minds what they want to do with the facts that I lay out in the book. But I think, you know, as consumers, one should be aware that if you spent, you know, money or whatever products these families own, you know, that your money can end up being having dividends can end up as the dividends for these families and can go towards maintaining, you know, massive charitable foundations, museums, academic chairs, corporate headquarters in the name of Nazi war criminals without any kind of transparency of who these men actually were, right?
Right, right.
Aside from their business successes, you know, but not the fact that they ran concentration camps or that they built concentration camps or that they exploited tens of thousands of forced slave laborers or that they were the largest weapons producers of the Third Reich. It's you know, it's for one to be cognizant of history, you know, and to kind of take moral responsibility for history as well. I mean, my book is an argument in favor of historical transparency.
Is it also in favor of reparations?
Well, I mean, the reparation question has already kind of been concluded. So those are long, those are generally long gone debates or long concluded debates. You know, there's still restitution going on with regards to art and particularly with art and real estate. But, but, you know, the compensation with regards to forced slave labor, the compensation question was concluded in the late 1990s. And of course, it's been many, many kind of restitution agreements that have been made between post 1945 and even still today with regards to the return of assets that were robbed or bought far under market value by, you know, Germans or other institutions.
David, is there anything left on the table in terms of Nazi billionaires? Something you felt like I should have brought up, but I didn't?
Yeah, I think it's important to realize, like, why did I chose these five families, for example, is that, you know, I wanted to focus on families that are still relevant in German, if in not only in German and European business, but in global business, and that are, you know, that have accumulated, that you know, not, for instance, like the family Krupp or Thyssen, who are not, you know, there's no families, there's no family anymore, there's no dynasty anymore, they don't play any significant role in global business. You know, and those that had profited the most. So they still had to be relevant today and in business and or finance. You know, and they had to also be, had to profit it, you know, not only through massive weapons production, but also through expropriation of Jewish owned assets and assets in German occupied Europe and the mass exploitation of forced and slave labor.
Is it worthwhile saying a quick word just to wrap up the book on Magda Friedlander?
I mean, plenty to say about her. You know, it's a little bit of an offside in the book in a way, but it's yeah. I mean, Magda Friedlander, Magda Rietschel, she was born. You know, was married for 10 years to Günter Quandt, the patriarch of the Quandt dynasty, and one son came out of that marriage, Harald Quandt. But she, of course, became later known as Magda Goebbels, you know, the First Lady of the Third Reich,
Who?
who ended up, who was married to Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi minister of propaganda, and who ended up murdering her six children in the Führer bunker on April 30th, 1945. And she, I mean, she's a bizarre character, fascinating character. Somebody who, her childhood boyfriend was Chaim Arlozorov, who became this very Zionist, famous Zionist. He was a Jewish guy. Her stepfather was Jewish. That's where she got the name Friedlander from. Then she married Günter Quandt, who, of course, one of the most powerful industrialists in Germany. And then she ended up, rising to infamy as Joseph Goebbels' wife. So certainly a multifaceted character. And yeah, the mother of Harald Quandt, who of course represents one of the branches of the Quandt family. And the only one to survive as an heir of Magda Goebbels or Magda Quandt.
Why in the first place did you decide to write this book and devote so much time and effort to compiling this document?
I think what struck me was when I was reporting in Germany, for Bloomberg, is the stories I always come back with were this mix of the financial business and the, financial, historical, and business aspects of things. And what struck me was that companies like BMW and Porsche, but particularly the families that control them, celebrate their business, their patriarchs, their fathers, their grandfathers for their business successes, but leave out their war crimes. And I think that's really why I decided to write the book, was to shine a light on this whitewashing of history. And that's also the book is also an argument in favor of historical transparency, is that you can't, if you only show the good of history, it doesn't really show anything. It's just a whitewash for in order, especially in the time of misinformation, of such misinformation and fake news, etc., that for these families with incredible economic responsibility, economic, financial, and therefore also political, also political responsibilities in that sense, kind of icons of German industry, or icons of Germany. That they are transparent about history, that they take up their moral responsibility. And that's something, German business as a whole has never really taken moral responsibility for the crimes of the Third Reich. And these families are continuing kind of negating that as well, negating that history.
As a historian, how often are you confronted with whitewashing, not just in Germany, but in other areas you cover?
Oh. I mean, I would say as a financial journalist rather than a historian, but both, I guess, so often, I mean, of course, companies always try to paint a rosier picture of their past and or their current, and then is actually the case.
How does that influence the way you look at anything older than like 200 years? I mean, how much can we really know? How much of that has been whitewashed and the actual events are just lost?
Oh wow, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I concern myself with contemporary events and contemporary history, so I try not to look past. I would say World War One, I would say World War One or like the past 150 years. I don't know. I mean, it's can't yeah but I would say that the Netherlands, if you look at kind of their slavery past or the colonial past, has or collaboration past, there's so much to reckon with in terms of their history.
Do you know the Tropenheim Museum? Is it called Tropenheim or Troop?
Tropenmuseum,
The
yeah.
Troop Museum.
Tropenmuseum, yeah.
So I remember going there when I lived in Amsterdam with my missus. And on the point you just made, it is supposed to be a museum dedicated to sort of the black history of the Netherlands. Or at least the
Yeah,
exhibition we saw at
well,
the
not the
time was
black
that.
history of the Netherlands, but it's like the colo yeah, kind of the colonial history of the
And
Netherlands, which in itself, right?
it did a very, very poor job of pointing out how integral the Dutch were in the slave trade, and the history of the East India Company, like, and so you talk about whitewashing, you know, it's something that's has stayed with me a little bit, how this museum, which was supposed to be dedicated to this, in fact, did a really good job at showing, you know, how good the Dutch were in some areas. Oh, they were bad in these areas, but overall, look what they've given to them.
Yeah, exactly. That's still, I would say, the prevailing Dutch sentiment. Like, definitely.
But if you're looking at documents that are 100, 150 years old and you can barely, you know, figure out what the... Well, you can figure it out, but you can notice all the attempts at whitewashing in between. It must...
Well, no, I look at the current events of whitewashing, right? Like where you have in Germany, the BMW Foundation, Herbert Quandt, you know, which has the quote, inspire responsible leadership, you know, after a man who, you know, built sub-concentration camp in German occupied Poland, who, you know, exploited thousands of forced slave laborers, men, women, from concentration camps and battery factories in Berlin, and who bought companies stolen from Jews in France. I mean, and then you have, you know, you have a massive charitable foundation in his name called, it's with it, the motto, inspire responsible leadership. I mean, that is really the, you know, just grotesque, you know, and its perversity and it's a blatant whitewashing, you know, and And then you have, you know, similar, and he's the father of the two BMW heirs. So, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of, examples that led me to write this book. It's kind of this really blatant and brazen whitewashing of history.
And so would you have them just acknowledge their history, you know, rename these awards, rename these charitable foundations, just say,
well, no, I mean it's very difficult to do it with private companies or institutions, right? So I think you should give them this, these are not municipalities or cities or whatever, where you, you know, where you can have voters or whatever, where you can, these are, yeah, these are private companies or private entities. So I think you should give them the option rather than immediately renaming. You should give them the option. If either you're fully transparent, radically transparent, you show their business successes and their war crimes. If you don't want to do that, you should rename them.
Well, look, talk a little bit about Israel. So you live there now. What about your work in Israel and Lebanon? What are you doing now?
Well, I work as a Middle East correspondent for the Dutch Financial Daily, which is a daily financial newspaper. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on well, there's always a lot going on in the Middle East, but particularly there's a lot going on in Israel at the moment. So it's quite busy. Yeah.
Why'd you move from Bloomberg?
Well, I left Bloomberg to write the book. So and that took me 4 years, 4.5 years. So then we moved because my fiance, she's a TV correspondent. She's German, and she's a TV correspondent for Israel and Palestine, and she. Yeah, she studied Hebrew and Arabic, and so that's why we moved, and then I got this you know, gig as a Middle East correspondent, and I think it's great.
So you moved for the family and then had to find a job that fit the move.
Yeah, basically, essentially. Yeah. Yeah.
And with the Dutch Financial Daily, are you doing the same type of investigative journalism into family offices, private wealth in the Middle East?
No, not as of yet. No, not yet. It's more geopolitical. It's more focused on business, finance, and geopolitics. But yeah.
Why did Nicholas ask me to ask you specifically about Lebanon?
I mean, well, because we've both spent time there, and I mean, I went there because Sophie, my fiance, she went there for a month to learn to brush up her Arabic, and I think it's a you know, I think it's a fascinating country. It's also, and I was back there in late 2021, as you know, to report on the economic crisis there. And I think it's, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, it's a tragedy what's happening with the country, you know, there, where it's just, yeah, it's kind of being plundered from the top, and yeah, I just think Beirut is a great place. It's just a wonderful city to spend time in, and the surrounding areas as well. And you know, you want to spend time in the mountains and in Fakra or Farija or in the, or on the sea in Batroun. You know, it's just a wonderful, it's a very hospitable place, you know.
So your missus speaks German, English, Arabic, and Hebrew.
And French.
My goodness. That's a crazy polyglot.
I know. She, yes. Yeah.
It must be fun traveling with her.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have to say a word. Yeah, exactly. No, I'm kidding. Yeah.
All right. Meneer de Jong. Three questions I try to ask as many guests as possible. The first, the role of serendipity in your life.
Oh, yeah. Massive. Massive, yeah. I mean, yeah. So many serendipitous events have led me to jobs or otherwise to, yeah. Serendipity is incredibly important. You know, I mean, coincidence, serendipity, yeah.
Definitely. One that
played a massive role in my life. Pooh. I mean, the reason I got introduced at Bloomberg was because I once, you know, I was having coffee. This was early 2010. I was having coffee with a friend, and this guy was reading a book, and we got into a conversation. And you know, we became friends, and then he was working at this is in New York, another newspaper, then he went to Bloomberg, and then when I was looking for jobs, he introduced me there, you know, and it was like a random coffee event. So I think that's definitely serendipitous.
100%. And you know, we can't, there's no counterfactual, there's no what if, but had you not known someone at Bloomberg, who's to say you would have worked at Bloomberg? Who's to say you would have then had
the education to
write Nazi billionaires and,
you know. Exactly, so exactly. See?
It's
exactly.
Incredible.
Yeah,
incredible.
Totally.
All right. Yeah. A country you're particularly bullish on?
Oh, wow. I'm bullish on Germany. Oh, no. That's a good... Let me give a sec to think about that one. I am bullish on Germany. I'm always bullish on Germany. I think Germany. I think that's yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a country that, you know, in its core, it's still very deeply conservative and also in many ways provincial and quite rigid. But I think, you know, I think it's a country with so much potential, even so much untapped potential. You know, if they would let go of this kind of this rigidity that they're stuck in, I think, you know, that, so I'm bullish because I think it has so much upwards potential, and so much upside still. Yeah.
Something I find really interesting about Germany from my limited experience in Europe is that they are so insular. Like all their media is German. All of their TV is German. They do not engage with the European community.
It's because they don't dub. This is my advice, sir. It's because they dub. You know, it's in German, like, because their language. I mean, if you know, and they're very self-conscious of that. But Germans and English, it's so bad. You know, and I grew up with nothing being dubbed. You know, you have subtitles. I mean. It's just, yeah, I think it's a crime, really, if you dub. But apparently the dubbing lobby in Germany, this is no joke, it's quite strong.
The dubbing lobby.
Yeah.
Who's the chief of dubbing?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's my new investigative story. But look, you know, but as a counter example, not only Netherlands, but if you go to Portugal, for example, Portugal, everybody speaks f like impeccable English. Like a lot of people speak impeccable English, and I always ask them why, because it's like so striking, especially if you come from Germany. And they're like, yeah, because we l look at, you know, our television programs or Netflix, nothing is dubbed, you know, we get really good, you know, it's like a really good way to learn English.
What is the untapped potential in Germany?
If you remove the control of the dubbing lobby, then, you know. No, I mean, I think it's still, it can be more international. It can be so much more international. It can be less hierarchical. It can be more modern. It can be more contemporary. It's so stuck always. It's always a couple decades behind, you know. I feel the Germans, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's the eight, I don't know where they are, you know, whether it's like, I feel like they got stuck somewhere in the, I don't know, 50s, 60s, 70s. I don't know. It's hard to gauge, but it's like, yeah. Well, it's something that the Dutch have and that the Germans don't. It's like innovation. They lack innovation. They can do so much more in terms of innovation of their products, of their businesses. You know, it's a certain kind of flexibility. Where you know, if they're, yeah, I mean, it's they're still, you know, the backbone of the economy is still the car industry. You know, innovation came really late there. On, yeah, so. Yeah, I would say
It's
that's
really funny you
really.
say that because I've sold two products to the European market. One was a booking system and one was a CRM. And anecdotally, Germany is such a bad market to call. One, because the language thing. Like even executives at these companies, a lot of the time will they won't speak English. And then they are using software like SAP, or they're using this software that was installed when they first went online in the 90s, and they never updated and they will never change. And even my German colleagues, you know, they have this perennial problem of the German won't pick up a cold call. They need to be introduced. It's a very old
No,
fashioned. You
yes,
must have a
true.
handshake. You must be in a
Yes,
boardroom
totally
with them.
true.
And it's quite funny that you say that because
Basically.
anecdotally, it does make them so much more rigid and old fashioned is what we would say. But then on the other side of things, and this complements what you said at the very, very beginning of the conversation, once you're in, and that's quite comforting and actually a great way to build relationships. All right, Mr. De Jong, final question. If you could listen to a podcast between any two people of history, dead or alive, no language barrier, who are you listening to?
I would definitely listen to a conversation between Stalin and Hitler. I mean, that would be if they, you know. Well, no, Hitler seemed like a terrible. I mean, they're both actually awful. Core. No. You want two more? No. Scrap that.
Yeah, you'd
Let's
rather
go
their
to
chief
more
of
positive.
communications each talk to each other.
Exactly. No, I mean, you want to have two really good speakers. You want to have two like really good like orators. So it would be like, I don't know, who's like famous, like kind of a, you know, like a JFK and a JFK and JFK and Obama or something, you know, like two, yeah, I will be, or JFK and Mandela or something, you know, like inspiring people, like, well, I mean, JFK was, yeah, yeah, something like that, you know, like just inspiring, like, yeah, not to arch villains, not to genocidal dictators. You want inspire. You want like. You want to take bring away of a kind of the great things of history. So yeah, something like that. JFK and Mandela, JFK and Obama. I mean, Obama and Mandela met, so people who hadn't, who haven't, who didn't, who never got a chance to meet each other.
All right, well, David, thank you for being so generous with your time. Thank you for the book.
My pleasure.
I loved it. It was right up my alley. Really, really interesting to read about. And
thank you.
I look forward in keeping tabs on everything you discover in the world of offshore finance and financial secrecy and all this chicanery.
Thank you, Ryan. It was a pleasure. Thanks for the time.